Network.
St. John Hunt is the eldest son of super spy E. Howard Hunt, a 27-year career CIA covert agent and foreign station chief, most well known as the leader director of the White House Plumbers Black Bag Team, whose botched burglary and arrest led to the impeachment and resignation of the President Richard Milhouse Nixon. And E. Howard Hunt, who passed away in January at the age of 88, was also involved in many of the CIA's most nefarious operations in Cuba and throughout Central and South America, including but not limited to the assassination of Che Guevara, assassination, and it just goes on and on, of the people in Chile, the coup in Guatemala, the orchestration of the Bay of Pigs, and the plots to assassinate Fidel Castro. So he was a black ops master, would be my term. And I just had a chance to talk to Mr. Hunt, St. James Hunt, his oldest son, during the break. I was flattered to learn that he is a listener and a reader of the website, and we're honored to have him. Last hour, we aired that 5 minutes. 15 more minutes is going to be going up on his site very, very soon. He's authorized us to play that. I want to have him back up when we do that. But it's happening in our lifetime. 43 years and some change later, you want somebody who was there, somebody who was, quote, on the bench as a commander. That's E. Howard Hunt. And that's the info we've gotten from Jim Mars and other experts. That's the info we've gotten from photographs. That's the info I got from the mistress, Madeline Duncan Brown, and the lawyer, Barr McClellan. I mean, we have it now in triplicate. We have a commander of the op. One of the commanders of the op, they always have multiple commanders. These things are always overlaid for redundancy and safety to make sure the op's carried out. We have the mistress, we have the lawyer, then we have all the circumstantial and physical evidence and the motive. It's absolutely off the charts, ladies and gentlemen. And so without further ado, I wanted to welcome to the airwaves St. John Hunt, the website stjohnhunt.com. We have links up on Infowars.com to his website right now, and we are honored to have him. Thank you for coming on, sir.
Well, thank you, Alex, for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
I certainly hope you get a publisher for the book you've written, because let me tell you, this is already dynamite and incendiary material, but isn't it surprising that you haven't found one quite yet?
Well, you know, I don't know if it's surprising or not. You know, the media is still probably reeling from the backlash as a result of the Oliver Stone JFK movie. I think that stung and certainly opened up a lot of people's eyes. But then, of course, the pendulum swings both ways. And so I think we're still probably in the very tail end of a backlash against that. And, of course, all of the great researchers, the people who have devoted their lives to researching this this terrible tragedy, this national tragedy, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, have been blackballed. They've been labeled as kooks, as nuts, as psychos, you know, by the right-wing media. And, you know, I think our day is come, and I think this is as close to a smoking gun as we're ever going to get.
I agree. Again, we're talking to St. John Hunt, the eldest son of E. Howard Hunt, with what he believed was a deathbed confession. He thought he was going to die 3 years ago and then gave this tape to his son, but then did die in January at the ripe old age of 88. He obviously believed he was a patriot for this country. There's so much to talk about. Your mother's there demanding more money from Nixon so you guys can defend yourselves. Her plane blows up. You've got just, you know, all these things that went on. Where do you start? I mean, where should we start?
Well, where it started for me was when I was 16 years old. My mother and my father sat me down and very calmly told me that my father, in fact, was not a State Department employee, that the certificates of commendation that he carried on his office wall at our home were, in fact, forgeries supplied to him by his true employer, which was a Central Intelligence Agency. And for me, that's when it really all began. I mean, prior to that, I was just a very confused child around, living a gypsy-like existence, being dragged from one country to another. By the time I was 9 or 10, I had already lived in Tokyo, Japan. I spoke rudimentary Japanese, and I moved to South of Latin America, to Montevideo, Uruguay, for 4 years. I attended a French school down there, so I was pretty confused by the time I was 16. I went lived in Mexico City, Madrid, Spain, Paris, France, and finally in this country. So I was kind of the oddball at school, never had any friends, never integrated into a social pattern. So when they told me, well, this is why your life is like this, it was with some shock. I didn't really understand what the CIA was at the time, and it wasn't until 1972 when my father came home on the night of the DNC break-in, when the four-man Cuban team was caught, that really sort of the heavens opened up and the weight of the world fell on my shoulders.
Absolutely. You began talking to your father years ago about the Kennedy situation. Can you just kind of put that in short form for the listeners and then get into the actual confession and the tape and what we haven't heard, what's on the 5 minutes and what he's talking about and the 15 minutes we haven't heard?
Well, my first inclination about any speculation or any allegation that my father was involved in the John F. Kennedy assassination came after. It was during when my father was in prison for Watergate, and I was making a phone call from a phone booth, and lo and behold, on a telephone pole right next to the phone booth was a large black and white poster saying CIA killed JFK, and right below that bold lettering were three photos, two of my father and one of someone that looked very much like my father, although he had a frumpled hat on and was somewhat dirty in the face. And this was one of these three tramps that had been photographed in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963. I tore that poster off and I just stared at it in a state of shock and stunned disbelief. So that was really the beginning of my quest for the truth about that. My father was released from prison, moved to Guadalajara, Mexico, where he was, he was out of this country and out of reach from me. Anyways, I did visit him several times over the years, but we never really got down to, the nitty-gritty until he summoned me down. He had been in the hospital for 19 months. He'd had two leg amputations. He'd had cancer of the jaw. He had prostate cancer. He had lupus and pleurisy, pneumonia. I mean, the list went on and on. He was very, very sick.
We're talking Darth Vader level here. He's had quite a bit of work.
Yeah, quite a bit of work. Yeah. So he summoned me down, and for all intent and purposes, it was my last visit to him, and he told me that he had information that was very important to him to give to me, and that I should do with it as I see fit. Once he was moved from the hospital bed at the hospital to his home in Miami, we had a number of occasions when there was no one else in the house where he hand wrote out 4 or 5 pages of extensive memos detailing the characters, the people that were involved in that plot to assassinate John F. Kennedy. And he told me there was probably a lot of there was talk in a lot of circles in the back rooms of the Miami and elsewhere, where there was people trying to organize a coup against President Kennedy, as he was thought to have been selling this country down and soft on communism. So that's so he gave me those memos. I returned back home to California, and about a month later, in January 2004, I go to my mailbox to pick up my mail, and there's an overnight postal packet in it from my father, and I opened it up. It was a single cassette where he was discussing the information about the John F. Kennedy assassination and pretty much supporting everything he had told me and he had written down in the handwritten memos that he had supplied to me earlier in the year.
Now, this literally is the Holy Grail. This is the sword in the stone. I mean, this is the coup de grace of the conspiracy culture of JFK. JFK is the zeitgeist. It is the core. It is what finally started killing the innocence of the American people so they could wake up to how they were being lied to. And now you have this tape. You have the handwritten notes. By the way, I hope you got I know you got copies everywhere because you're in danger,
buddy. They're
disseminated
everywhere.
That's smart. And I'm glad you're starting to dole this stuff out and, you know, get it out. That's a smart way to get as much attention as possible for your safety. This is key, what you're doing. Obviously, you know that, you know, better than I.
Yes, sir.
And for people to understand how big this is, Kevin Costner offered millions for this. Kevin Costner, who you've spoken with, physically visited your father in Florida and tried to get this information from him. Can you briefly tell folks that story?
Well, that's kind of a very interesting story. My father and Kevin Costner have a mutual friend, though Costner and my father had never spoken and never met. But this gentleman was a close friend of Kevin Costner's. I won't mention his name on the air in case he doesn't want to be, linked to this. But anyways, he brought Kevin Costner down. There was some deceit going on. It wasn't a deceit on Kevin Costner's part. Kevin Costner wanted to very much offer my dad a lot of money to come out with any information he might have known about JFK. At the time, nobody really knew what my dad knew because he hadn't told anybody yet. But anyways, Kevin Costner flies down and is introduced to my father by this mutual friend, and Kevin just blurts out, "So who killed JFK?" My father was in his his jaw dropped, and he turned around and looked at his wife and said, "What did he say?"
Yeah, that was, I mean, Kevin probably would have got it if he stayed in Miami 2 weeks and got to know him, but yeah, you can't just blurt it out.
Yeah, and my father was under the impression at the time, very innocently, that Kevin Costner was coming down to talk about doing a movie script about my father's life. So the two, what my father's impression of Kevin Costner was didn't match what Kevin Costner was down there for. So the whole thing just kind of blew up in its face, and that was the end of that. Although we did contact Mr. Costner on the phone, and we did try to negotiate some kind of arrangement.
Tell you what, stay there. Let's talk about that when we get back. Maybe he'll still do the movie now. This is so exciting. We'll be right back.
It is a big idea. A new world order.
In the near future. StJohnHunt.com. Excellent website. Filled with important information. This is a short segment. Long segment coming up, and then one more. Plenty of time to talk about this important story with our guest, but I want to have him back up for another hour, if he'll grace us, to discuss the longer tape he's going to be releasing and to maybe even take some of your phone calls. St. John Hunt, continuing, you said you were talking to Kevin Costner over the phone later, still trying to work something out with him. Absolutely. Talk about being vindicated. Kevin Costner, what, making a documentary, a movie? I mean, what was he wanting to do at the time? What was he looking for?
Well, what he was looking for, he wanted to he had gotten, he's kind of, in his own personal life, after he did the JFK movie for Oliver Stone, I guess he became somewhat of a conspiracy enthusiast. And, when he was approached by the mutual friend, I know E. Howard Hunt, maybe he has some information. It's long been speculated that he may have done this or done that. So let's try to see if we can get him to disclose some information. Kevin was very enthusiastic about it. What he wanted to do was he wanted to film a documentary. He wanted to have my father disclose whatever information. Well, first he wanted to find out if my father had any information. So what my father devised was a code key, a code and a key to give Mr. Costner the relevant information without naming the names. So my father, being a pretty smart and intellectually man, he developed this code that listed the that talked about the big event, which was the Kennedy assassination. That was what it was referred to during the planning stages of it in Miami, he told me. But he listed out a chain of command and a timeline, series of events and things that took place, along with all the most important players in the plot. Well, we provided this information to Kevin Costner, and he said, "Well, this is dynamite stuff. We have to go with this." But you have to understand at the same time that as my father was recovering from his illnesses, He's handled by what I call his own sort of Miami mafia, and these are family members and attorneys whose job, at least they feel, is to what they would, in their opinion, is protect my father. But from my point of view, it's to repress and suppress my father. Of course, my father is still under a secrecy agreement with the Central Intelligence Agency. And so now that his book has come out, American Spy, you know, that had to go through all kinds of scrutiny levels within the agency in order to be published. So by the time it was realized by my father's second family, by his wife, and by the attorneys that there was going to be some serious disclosure going on, some new relevant information about JFK, they just put the lid on and they clamped it down tight. So that project never got off the ground.
You know, I hate to bring up your mother, but you talk about it in the Rolling Stone interview, and if you could elaborate, that would be very informative. Because the way it's described in the article is, you guys needed money to live. You've been hung out to dry. She's going back to get more money from Nixon. And on her way back, the plane mysteriously has a problem. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I can. From what I know, it's documented that my father was in jail at the time. And, my mother had just returned from a summer vacation in Europe with the other children. So she was in a position, and of her own free will, I might add, she was the sort of quote unquote bag lady for the Watergate. Now her responsibility was to make demands of the Nixon White House, to press for more funds for the Cuban families. There was the families of the four Cubans, the McCord family and the Liddy family and our family. So there was a lot of mouths to feed. There was a lot of attorney bills to pay. And she also was in charge of giving funds, what you call them, bribes to people to keep quiet. So she was traveling around the country a lot. She was meeting with people from the Nixon White House in dark garages late at night, picking up keys that were placed underneath park benches, and then going to Greyhound bus depots in the middle of the night, dark parking lots, parked cars, picking up undeclared slush fund money from the committee to reelect the president, and traveling around and paying people off for their silence, as well as the attorneys to continue the defending of all the Cubans and the other members who had been arrested. So she got on a plane to take some money to Chicago. There's several theories about what she was doing with that money.
Tell you what, St. John, stay there. Let's come back and talk about that, and talk about the book you're working on and what your father told you, and maybe some elaboration on the tape that has been released. We really appreciate your time. Ladies and gentlemen, this incredible interview will continue.
We're on the march. The Empire's on the run. Alex Jones and the GCN Radio Network.
Is credit card debt making your life stressful? Do you avoid answering the phone and...
here today, and I know he's going further than he has in some previous interviews, and I want to get into the central area of the assassination here in a moment, but St. John Hunt is our guest. We're going to have him back up again in the near future. We just can't do this in an hour with 44 minutes of airtime. St. John, please continue where we left off with your mother flying to Chicago and what happened.
Well, okay, she was on a flight to Chicago from Washington D.C., and she was carrying a substantial amount of cash, between $10,000 and $100,000. It's never been accurately determined. Also, she was carrying with her information that would cause the Nixon White House to to be pressured into continuing paying the what they considered was the hush money, and that information was canceled checks from a Mexican bank in the account of Bernard Barker that came directly from the committee to reelect the president, or what's been called CREEP. This information was to serve to blow the Nixon White House out of the water if they didn't continue paying off the hush money. The plane flies into Chicago, is rerouted and diverted to a different airport, and within moments of the crash, there was 50 FBI and DIA agents on the ground cordoning the crash off, telling the police and fire department to stand down until they were finished sorting through the wreckage. They were probably looking for that suitcase, or at least making sure it had been destroyed. The FBI illegally came into the tower control room and confiscated all the tapes that had been recorded between that airplane and the tower. The very next day, December 9th, 1972, Nixon's top White House aide, Eagle Bud Crow Jr., was appointed Undersecretary of Transportation, which supervised the National Transportation Safety Board and the Federal Aviation Administration, the two agencies that investigate the plane crash. December 19th, a White House deputy assistant to Nixon and undersecretary to the cabinet, Alexander Butterfield, was appointed as a new head of the FAA. Later on, Dwight L. Chapin was appointed a top executive of United Airlines. So there was a huge scrambling to get this plane crash, sealed up and,
I've seen the sums that were being paid to the dutiful servants of Nixon. They weren't that big. People needed this for attorneys and to live, and the men were going to prison and keeping their mouths shut. Why didn't those bastards take care of their people?
No, because those bastards were of a very thin makeup. They didn't want to follow through. I mean, my father told me that in the covert ops world, if you're taken prisoner, if you die in the service of your country, your family is well taken care of. That's just an unwritten rule that everybody understands. And he just assumed, naively, I guess, that these people would follow the same line of reasoning. But Nixon was really willing to pay. You can hear him on the transcript saying, what is it going to take to keep Hunt quiet? $1 million? We could come up with that, he says. You know, we can get that kind of money.
We can get more, yeah.
We can get more, yeah. I mean, he had a huge war chest.
Yeah, he had Texas oil money, unlimited.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, but, you know, he was advised by his staff that we've got to cut loose of this. You know, we can't just keep paying these people.
Which a lot of evidence now shows that Kissinger the whole time was really setting Nixon up.
It seems that way, doesn't it?
Yeah, let's just blow her out of the air and let's just not do, I mean, unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
He would have never gone down if they had just taken care of everybody.
Right. Well, I can't speculate on what would have happened, but we certainly know what did happen.
Unbelievable treachery. There's so many facets to this. Can you just recap basically what's on the tape? You have 15 minutes more. Maybe give us a hint of what's on that. Any other areas that are safe for you to talk about, anything that hasn't been revealed or that's in those written notes that you have. And I mean, obviously, I want the story because I want to expose these people so they don't keep getting away with it. But also, you're a smart guy for your safety. Is there anything else in those pages that people need to know about?
Well, there's a lot of information on those pages, and there's additional information on the rest of the tape. But what we have up on my website, stjohnhunt.com, is a 4.5-minute edited version, most of the editing revolves around the fact that my father was fairly sick when he made that. So there's a lot of heavy breathing, a lot of pausing, a lot of fumbling with the recorder controls. But he made that tape.
You know what, though? I think it'll be 10 times more powerful if you put it out unedited. I understand why you edited it, but I think people hearing the rattling and the rest of it's important.
Yeah, he's got that death rattle in his voice, and he's, you know, fumbling with the record button, but the tape is interesting in its entirety, and we're going to try to get that up as soon as we can. The memos that have never been seen before that he wrote me outline the chain of command, starting with LBJ. He drew a box around LBJ's name, and then linked that to Cord Meyer, and then to the right he linked that to David Phillips, and then below Phillips was a line going to William Harvey, and then from Harvey there was a spidering out to Antonio Veciana, Frank Sturgis, David Morales, and Lucien Sarti. The second page of the handwritten memos is a full document, you know, handwritten all the way from the top to the bottom, outlining information about each of those individuals. And he wrote, over the period of a week, he wrote about four pages of memos to me, which he entrusted to me. And, of course, when the lid slammed down on him by his attorney and his second family, he asked for all that stuff back, and unbeknownst to him, I made copies of it and kept my copies and gave him the originals back, and I'm certainly so glad that I did that.
Absolutely, and then the media was balking at your memos, but on top of that, you've got the tape, which is clearly E. Howard Hunt.
Yes, oh, absolutely, there's no doubt.
Now, expanding on this, it's not just that there's the Dallas Morning News and Dallas Time Herald photos of all these tramps being picked up, being released from the police station, all of this. There's also the fact that you do have Frank Sturgis right next to what's clearly your father. There's three different photos. And then another known CIA guy. I mean, when you've got them lined up together and you do side by sides, I mean, the Sturgis thing, this is a dead ringer.
I mean,
there's no debating. And then that's what the police and others said and the eyewitnesses said.
Yeah, no, I agree. As my father's son, I just, every time I look at that comparison photo between the tramps and my father, it looks like my father to me. Now, I can't say definitively if it is him or not.
But then you add that with Sturgis, who's closer in the photos. I mean, it's Sturgis.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he's a pretty handsome, swashbuckling looking guy, and it's Frank Sturgis. He looks like somebody out of a movie, you know, of the 50s of what a CIA commando would look like.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that certainly does look like Frank. I've met Frank before, and I can say that my gut feeling that certainly looks like Frank too. Of course, you know, in more recent times, people have come forward to say that they were the tramps. But I think we have at least two people for every tramp now that are claiming to be the tramps.
Yeah, well, you got a lot of. I mean, anytime there's a murder, you're going to have four or five people show up saying they did it or complete moonbats.
Right.
But expanding on that line. Now, what I'd always gotten from all the experts and people I'd interviewed living here in Texas and talking to people who've even been out to shooting ranges and things and mistresses and all the rest of it, and his lawyer, and some things that haven't even been on air, by the way, folks, that I'm not allowed to talk about. I don't even like to say but the point is, this is all dangerous stuff.
Yeah.
The point is though, the info I got is your dad was not pulling triggers. He was there kind of in a command function.
Yeah, I would agree with that. If he was directly involved like that, he was definitely not one of the shooters, because that's just not the kind of job that they would have given to a man like my father. My father had one foot in the front lines, and he had the other foot firmly in place in the suit and tie world. So they would have brought in someone like a Corsican gunman, a Cuban gunman, or something like that. And of course, my father did always believe that Lee Harvey Oswald was firing from the rear.
Now, Oswald, we've now got his CIA control number. We know he was in Black Ops. Do you think they just hung him out to dry as the patsy, as they do so many times?
Yeah, I think so. I think Oswald was a very tragic figure. I think he was being sheep-dipped by many intelligence, by all kinds of people for their own personal reasons and for their, as someone, I mean, that can be used as a patsy, and I think that's exactly what happened. I don't think he was really aware of what was happening. And if he did fire,
they also did that with McVeigh. Now, of course, it's come out in sealed affidavits that I've seen, because I saw it before it was sealed, and with other eyewitnesses. I mean, we have the names. It fits with everything else we knew. That they took him out of special ops. He did not wash out, folks. And then they had him, and they set him up big time, too.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably correct, yeah. Yeah, I don't know much about that story, though.
Well, I mean, it's the classic thing of the general sacrificing the troops to lure in the enemy. I mean, this is 101 military operations.
Yeah, it is. And as far as my dad's history with the agency goes, I think, you know, he was sadly hung out to dry by the agency and by the government that he so dutifully served and loved so dearly.
Now, did he tell you why he went along with the killing of JFK? I mean, did you ever ask Dad why? I mean, did he say, oh, because we thought he was a communist, or what did he say?
Well, he told me that that within the intelligence circles, it was felt that it was an imperative situation that President Kennedy not be allowed to to serve in that office for any longer, because there was a lot of crucial things coming down. There was the Vietnam War. Was probably one of the main reasons. There was also the anger and the threats that Kennedy had made to splinter the CIA into 1,000 pieces. My father was, prior to Kennedy's administration, was really looking to become eventually the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. He had been a 27-year career person. He had been in the original OSS, which was the predecessor to the CIA. And because of Kennedy's lack testicular fortitude, he withheld the air cover at the Bay of Pigs, and that whole thing just brought everything down.
What about the photos?
A lot of hatred for Kennedy.
Sure. We have the control documents declassified with the George H. W. Bush being in the CIA. We know he went into CIA before he became the director in the mid '70s, claiming that was his first time ever being there. We know that there are very clear two different photographs that are clearly, I mean, if they're not, it's his twin brother, George Herbert Walker Bush, in Dallas outside the book suppository, a depository building. We have all that right there. Did your father ever say anything about George H.W. Bush?
No, he never discussed George H.W. Bush to me.
You know about his support in the Bay of Pigs and with the oil company and the drilling rigs, and it named after his wife.
No, I'm not aware of those things. I don't know about that. It's interesting, though. I'd like to look into it.
Well, in the article we wrote that's up on Infowars.com today, in the guest section, was written on Monday, you can go in there and look at all. I'm sure you've seen the famous photos of what looks like your father with some of the other operatives, but then, yeah, we've got the photos there of George Herbert Walker Bush, and that's the intel I've always gotten. Are you aware that some prominent individuals talked about your father, E. Howard Hunt, being at that meeting the night before at the big oilman's house in Dallas?
No, I'm not aware of that. That's interesting. And who are these individuals?
Well, that has come out with Madeleine Duncan Brown and with Jim Mars and many others. But Madeleine Duncan Brown, of course, was his mistress.
Yeah. Yeah, I heard that she has a book out. I haven't read it yet, but she supports the Lyndon Baines Johnson theory of who's responsible.
And so does his lawyer, Barr McClellan. Yeah, she died a few years ago, but I interviewed her on the radio several times. Then we also, former NSA operative Robert Galen Ross, interviewed her a few years ago on video. We have that up on prisonplanet.tv. I'll send you a free membership so you can watch it.
No, thank you. Thank you so much, sir. Yeah, well, I'll definitely look into it.
Any other facets, any other areas, tidbits, pieces of information do you think we should know? Again, we're talking to the son, the firstborn son of E. Howard Hunt, the legendary black op commander for the CIA.
Boy, it's such a huge story. I think, you know, overall, my father left a lot of unanswered questions with me. Our relationship was cut short by the powers that surrounded my father in the last few years of his life. And at the very end, he had to, can't just submit to the wishes of those people that were immediately around him. He was, you know, very worried and concerned. He knew that his disclosures in Watergate and his infamy had led to the splintering of his first family, the death of his wife, and so he was also very concerned that that any new revelations that would come out, since he was still going to be alive for a few more years, would have had a dramatic negative effect on his second family, which he did not want to put them through.
Did he get angry when your mother was killed? When your mother died,
was he angry?
Did he instantly know who was behind it?
Well, you know, he was in prison at the time, and so you know, he was let out to go and identify the body. Where he was in jail, actually, before he was sentenced. But he had never discussed it with me, and he had always just, the only time he said anything to me about it was that he thought it was just pilot error. Of course, later on in his life, at one of these deaths, or one of these bedside confessions, I was talking to him about trying to, you know, bring my sisters into the fold again and have them forgive my father, because they held a lot of things against him. They blamed him for the death of our mother. And I said, you know, I've been talking to my sisters and trying to get them to come down and see you. And he started, the tears started welling up in his eyes, and he said, you know, Saint, I was so worried. So I was so deeply concerned that what happened to your mother, that what they did to your mother, they could have done to you children. And that caused the hair on my neck to stand up. That was the first disclosure from my father that he thought there was something else going on besides just the sheer pilot error.
Unbelievable. Serve the Dark Lords and they strike down your wife. We'll be back with a final segment with St. John Hunt. I'm Alex Jones. This is the GCN Radio Network as we make history.
It is a big idea. A new world order.
In the near future. For now, tomorrow, forever gone. St. John Hunt, stjohnhunt.com is the website. I'm going to have him back up next week for a full hour to take your calls. You cannot do this in 1 hour interview. Maybe we'll even have him up for an hour and a half. But again, I appreciate your courage, sir. Everything you've said meshes with the information I've gotten over a decade plus of research and interviewing others who've researched for 30, 40 years. You know, I think your father reprieves himself by going public at the end. And people who always want some type of deathbed confession, or for one of the actual people involved to go public, here it is. With everything else, this has got to really discredit the mainstream media and the official line in the Warren Commission. Can you comment on that?
Well, I think it really does, and I think my father was very brave for coming out with this. I think he felt an obligation, even though it went against his grain to implicate his own government. I think he felt the greater need to disclose the truth, and I'm happy that he disclosed that truth to me.
Well, that was the question I was going to ask you. Why do you think they never tried to take him out? They thought they had him under their control?
Well, I think they did, and you know, he sat quietly. You know, he did his time in prison, and then the rest of his life he became just a kind of a regular guy. He wrote his novels, one or two a year, and lived quietly, raised a new family, and basically just you know, stayed out of the limelight. The last thing he wanted was to create a huge storm of controversy around his new life. I think he'd been shown quite severely what the government is willing to do to control aspects. And so, you know, his wife had been killed, and his family had been splintered to the far ends of the country. And he just he knew, you know, this was a hard ball game situation, and I think he just was very intimidated by that.
But I think the fact that he did finally go public at the end does show a lot of courage.
It does show a lot of courage. It
and I think, I mean, I think a novel just about how they, I hate to say this to his son, but how they took your father, I think genuinely was a pro-American person, and to watch how they twisted him.
Yeah. Well, he was definitely handled and manipulated by people of self-serving interests, Nixon and his cronies. You know, this was a man that they knew was operating on a patriotic stand, and they just took that and they just, you know, manipulated my father.
And in your research, there's no doubt that, I mean, I know there's no doubt here that clearly Nixon and LBJ, it's two birds of a feather. They're just two operatives for even bigger powers.
Yes, I would assume so, because the you know, the president is kind of, is you know, kind of like an empty office. And
you also told me, sure, you also told me during the break, and we're about to enter, that's why I'm hurrying, that 60 Minutes was going to do this, but passed. It took 4 weeks longer for the LA Times to do a whitewash on this. I mean, they're still scared, aren't they?
Yeah, I think they are. I think they are. So I'm really thankful for your show, sir, to allow me to bring this information out, and thank God for the Internet as well.
Well, I'm thankful for you, and we talked during the break. You said that you have said more here than you said anywhere else. I'm honored that that happened, and I'm also honored to find out that you were aware of my work, and I look forward to talking to you next week. And as soon as that book comes out, we want to carry it, and we want to support the work you're doing. And again, we appreciate your courage. StJohnHunt.com is the website. St. John, God bless you. We'll be praying for you.
Thank you, Alex.
Folks, don't forget, we have the online video and bookstore at InfoWars.com. If you want to support the work we're doing here as we try to stop this country from turning into a fascist dictatorship, because if you think LBJ and Nixon were bad, the people running things now make them look like choir boys. So InfoWars.com, be sure and visit the site, or get a membership at PrisonPlanet.tv for all that JFK coverage. God bless you all.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Now, from the makers of Loose Change, the most downloaded film in internet history, comes the long-awaited release of Loose Change Final Cut, an entirely new two-hour film that completely destroys the official fable forever. Loose Change Final Cut hopes to be a catalyst for a new independent investigation in which family members receive answers to their questions and the true perpetrators of this horrendous crime are brought to justice. Loose Change Final Cut is the ultimate 9/11 expose. From hijackers being trained at U.S. military bases to bombs in the buildings, Loose Change Final Cut is the one 9/11 film everyone must see. Secure your copy of Loose Change Final Cut today at InfoWars.com or PrisonPlanet.com. While you're visiting the online video store, be sure to check out the huge discounts on films like Endgame, Blueprint for Global Enslavement, America, Freedom to Fascism, and hundreds of other titles. We're in a no-holds-bar information war. Truth is our weapon, and PrisonPlanet.com has the tools you need to take the fight back to Big Brother.
You have the power.
This is the GCN Radio Network.